It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A grand jury report released 1 year ago detailed hundreds of instances of child sex abuse by Catholic clergy. It shook the faith of some Catholics. Some left the church. Others decided to push for change from within. Kevin Hayes is an architect. He's also the chairperson of a group working with the Pittsburgh Diocese called Catholics for Change in Our Church. Kevin, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Do you know many Catholics personally that have left the church as a result of this scandal?
Yes, I have. And I do.
And is it troubling for you, who is somebody who has obviously kept his faith?
It's very troubling for me, particularly with some very close friends who have been lifetime Catholics, who have raised their children in the church, and they have now left.
Is it more that they still have their faith, but have lost trust in the leadership of the church?
Yes, I would say that. Their faith is important to them, and they felt they needed to go to another church to practice that faith.
Another Christian denomination?
Yes.
Okay. How did your organization come about? Was it spontaneous?
It was somewhat spontaneous, more organic. It was a group of people, initially in the South Hills, who were very concerned about the revelations in the report, and we just started talking and discussing what could we do about it.
And that was during a listening session where you started coming together?
Yes. One of the things that group did was decide last September that we wanted to have a listening session to bring people together and give them a forum to express their feelings and thoughts.
Was the bishop there? Was Bishop Zubik there at that time?
He was not at that particular listening session, but he did have four listening sessions later in the year.
So how many members do you have, and who are these people?
We have roughly 1,000 members. They're Catholics all over the diocese, north, east, south, and west. And again, they all care about their church, and they want to see changes made to it.
Sounds like they're vested in their faith. They attend Mass regularly?
Yes, I would say the large majority of the members of CCOC attend Mass regularly and are very involved in their parishes as lectors, Eucharistic ministers, you know, ministries, etc.
Bishop Zubik appeared on this program last year, just a matter of days after the release of the grand jury report. I understand that you wrote a letter to the bishop around the same time, and since then you've had a few meetings with him. Were you blunt with him? What you wanted, what you hoped for in those meetings?
We have been, and to his credit, he's been open to hearing what we have to say. So yes, we have been blunt.
Did he get it? Did he get your message?
That's a hard question. I would say that he heard us, and part of what we realized was this was going to take ongoing dialogue. And again, to the bishop's credit, he said, I'd like to meet with you. We asked him if we could, and he said yes, he would meet with us every 2 months to continue the dialogue.
Heard us, but acting is another thing?
Yes. And again, in fairness to the bishop, he's a part of an organization that's lasted 2,000 years and has a very clerical structure that doesn't change easily.
Our guest on the Confluence is Kevin Hayes. He's chairperson of Catholics for Change in Our Church. Your organization is focusing on several key areas, including lay oversight of diocesan function. I think most of us understand the need for oversight, given the report. But what about the function needs to change?
Good point. And the way I would answer that is we're really looking for co-responsibility of the laity with the clergy. You know, we're not a revolution, we're an evolution. And we're looking to have an impact where laity find their voice and are able to step up and be co-responsible with the clergy for managing the parishes as well as the hierarchy.
Co-responsibility. Anybody who knows anything about the Catholic Church knows it's a very structured, hierarchical entity. How is that idea being accepted by the bishop? How easy, difficult would it be to implement co-responsibility?
Again, I appreciate that the bishop and some of his senior advisors are open to talking to us about it. But change is difficult, and it is going to be a very big challenge, both for Bishop Zubik as the head of the church here in Pittsburgh to change as the bishop, but then also all of his staff around him and the structure of the church around him. And again, it's going to take time, but we think it's necessary to start in that direction.
In April, Bishop Zubik appointed four members to a new secretariat for the protection of children, youth, and vulnerable adults. The four were already within the diocesan administration. Is that a problem, or is it a help because they already know the workings of the diocese?
Both. So it definitely helps that there is representation of the diocese on any commission or any advisory board that's created because of what you just said, that there is a need to know how things work in the diocese. However, our point has been, and we mentioned it in the public statement that we released 2 weeks ago on the anniversary of the first of the grand jury report being released last year, that what needs to change is this idea of co-responsibility. The commission that was changed, it's a very good idea on the bishop and the diocese part, but we're looking to see if there's independent lay people that can be appointed. So it's not somebody appointed by the bishop or the diocese. It's appointed by other groups, such as religious orders of men and women, but also perhaps CCOC and other groups of active lady.
What about parish councils? Most, if not all, parishes have their own councils with various committees. Could you see that as a possibility of sending representatives to a group that are independent?
Very much. And it is in the parish where I think we're going to see the most and greatest chance of making change immediately. And parish councils, as you mentioned, both finance councils and parish councils exist, but often in name only in many parishes. The pastor rules like a dictator, and they don't really welcome input from the laity. And that's one of the things we're looking to change.
And that varies from parish to parish, just how accepting the pastors, now called administrators, are.
That is correct. Some pastors do welcome the advice and input of laity. Many, unfortunately, do not.
Our guest on The Confluence is Kevin Hayes. He is the chairperson of Catholics for Change in Our Church. Have you seen any progress, any promising developments over the last 12 months since the release of the grand jury report?
Yes, we have. I mean, and I'll speak for CCOC first, and then I'll comment on the diocese. I mean, we have seen a tremendous response to our message of laity getting involved and speaking their needs and their feelings about what has to happen in our church for it to not only survive but thrive. We've also seen an openness on the part of the diocese and some of the people in the diocese to engaging in dialogue with us, again, as we mentioned, the bishop and others, and that's been positive, but much more needs to be done.
A victims fund has begun providing some compensation. Is that enough? Do you want to see a window of opportunity for victims to sue, even if the current statute of limitations has expired?
We would like to see that window extended and the four recommendations from the grand jury implemented.
And one of those is a window, want to extend the statute of limitations. Church leaders have indicated that the financial awards from the courts in such cases could bankrupt dioceses, and as a result, reduce or eliminate the charitable work that they do for a variety of other organizations. Your reaction to that?
We feel that the justice for the victims outweighs protecting the institution of the church.
And so the...
If there were financial repercussions and they were negative and there would be a need for the diocese to claim bankruptcy, in order to get justice for the victims, we think that's appropriate to pursue that path and deal with those consequences.
We have just a couple minutes left. Your organization is also calling for the strengthening and diversifying of the clergy. What do you mean by that?
Well, as quickly as I can, number one, parish priests are right now dealing with almost a perfect storm in terms of the difficulties of not only dealing with the consequences of the grand jury report, but also dealing with the reorganization that are occurring, as well as the reduction in attendance as well as donations. So they need to be supported. But we also feel that the church must look at the possibility of involving women in not only the diaconate, but long-term in the priesthood, as well as possibly married priests, in order, again, for not only the churches to survive, but thrive.
Well, that idea has to go all the way up the order to Rome.
It does. And, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. It's not going to change in a day. But we have to start the journey one step at a time.
You have another meeting scheduled with the bishop, one of your regular meetings in September. What specifically do you hope comes from this?
We hope number one, for ongoing dialogue. One of the topics that we agreed to at our last meeting was we're going to talk about clericalism, what it means to both sides of the discussion, and what can be done to reduce it.
And is it a debate within your organization? Should Bishop Zubik continue to lead this diocese?
It is very much a debate, and the members of CCOC are split. Currently, the leadership believes that Bishop Zubik is sincere and wants to try to make the changes that are needed, and we're willing to work with him as long as we see some progress as we go forward.
But that split and that disagreement has not split your organization?
No, it hasn't. We've agreed to disagree and continue on.
Kevin Hayes is the chairperson of Catholics for Change in our church. Thanks so much for coming by today.
Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Archaeologists have dug up artifacts from 8,000 years ago near Blairsville, the site of an early 19th century settlement. What can we learn from this dig about the people that lived there so many years ago? And Robert Morris University, a private school, is trying to prove it can beat the prices students pay at public universities in Pennsylvania and in other states. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Send us an email to confluence@wesa.fm. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the McKeesport police are told they may not, quote, stand and converse with females while on duty in 1943. The Pittsburgh Press reports the department was given a 37-page booklet that included new rules such as no smoking on the job, no sleeping, and no habitual profanity. The article says officers read the book diligently and were told that extortion of money or blackmail would result in their dismissal. At the time, women were not permitted on the force, but were able to serve as crossing guards. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The nation's population is growing at its slowest rate since the Great Depression. But the Amish community, with a strong presence in central Pennsylvania, is growing at about six times the rate of the general population. WITF's Rachel McDevitt spoke to members of the Amish and non-Amish communities to see how the growth is putting pressure on both communities. A note, you won't hear the voices of Amish people in this story because most do not allow themselves to be recorded.
Let me see here, Lancaster.
Edsel Burge likes to say he counts babies, but really, he's tracking Amish births as he sits in an office crammed with filing cabinets and shelves upon shelves of newsletters, newspapers, magazines, and a collection of thick and thin bound volumes.
This is my shelf of Amish directories.
Burge is a research associate at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College, and his main task is to work on the center's annual estimated census of Amish in the United States.
They took the care to actually add everything up. And so you can see the growth.
All the records are provided by the Amish. Burge is paging through a hefty volume for one settlement in northern Indiana.
One should wish all Amish directories were so kind. I don't have to do a lot of counting with that one.
The Amish population nearly doubles every two decades. According to the Young Center's most recent tally, it now stands at more than 336,000 nationwide. And for a place like Lancaster County, which accounts for about 10% of the population, that means things are starting to feel a little crowded for both the Amish and who they call the English, like in Strasburg Township, where some are having trouble finding a place for their horses.
What I'm going to show you is where we've accommodated Amish in small rural housing.
Okay. Michael Weaver is driving around the township in his black Jeep Wrangler, pointing out the results of an ordinance that he and his colleagues on the Board of Supervisors passed last year.
This is a prime example right here of...
He puts his flashers on and stops outside a fairly modest beige ranch house with what appears to be a large garage.
A plot of ground that's no more than a half acre.
It used to be you needed 1 acre of land per horse to keep the animal on your property, but the township zoning board was getting inundated with requests for exceptions from Amish moving into homes on smaller lots. So the supervisors voted to allow up to two horses for the purpose of transportation to be kept on a half-acre lot.
And they were raised in Strasburg Township, the vast majority, and they want to remain here, which I was raised in Strasburg Township, and I also want to remain here. So I have great sympathy and empathy for that position.
The ordinance includes restrictions on the buildings used to shelter the horses and requirements for storing manure.
We were trying to prevent so many zoning requests, but we have found with the new ordinance, many of the Amish have asked for variances on the size of the carriage house.
So they want them a little bigger?
They want them a little bigger.
The Amish in Lancaster County are closely associated with agriculture, but only about a third are still farming. Most work in other trades, own businesses, or work construction, so they don't need as much land. And for young Amish, the price is out of reach.
The farms have gone up in value tremendously, and that's basically from desire to own farmland for the Amish and Mennonites. They've driven the price, triple in my time.
Bill O'Brien is the chief lending officer for the Bank of Bird in Hand. He's been financing agricultural loans for more than 30 years, and he's watched as the price for an acre of farmland in the county grew from about $8,000 to $20,000.
But certainly you could make money farming here, but we've reached the point where price of farms per acre is well beyond the income-producing ability of it. So
the high cost is one of the reasons some Amish are picking up and moving. Edsel Burge at the Young Center has taken note.
But in more recent years, what I've noticed, though there have been some Amish households leaving Lancaster County, going to new settlements. And recently, actually this last year, there was a significant, and when I say significant, I mean like maybe 20 households leaving Lancaster County.
It's but really finances aren't the only reason Amish families decide to leave their homeland.
I have seen a cultural clash between the Amish community and the English.
Township Supervisor Michael Weaver says that's coming mostly from the non-Amish against the Amish's rural lifestyle. That clash can be another factor pushing the Amish, who must work to preserve their faith, culture, and traditions as the modern world encroaches on their way of life. Rachel McDevitt in Strasburg Township, Lancaster County.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. You start digging around, you never know what you're going to find. A group of students from Indiana University of Pennsylvania and their professors discovered something unexpected while working on an archaeological dig near Blairsville. Artifacts that could date back as far as 8,000 years ago. Here to tell us about the dig are Ben Ford. He's the chair of the Department of Anthropology. Bill Chadwick is the director of Archaeological Services. And students Nadia Meister and Jamie Kuba. Welcome to The Confluence. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, thank you.
All right, let's start with the location. Ben, let me start with you. Just describe where this is.
So near Blairsville is a good description of it. It's near the confluence, to use your title, of the Black Lick and the Conemaugh River. And it sits next to the Conemaugh in Indiana County on Corps of Engineers property. And so it's federal property where the site is, but it's just upriver from Blairsville.
Did you need any special permission since it's federal property?
Yeah, there's a whole process to be allowed to excavate on federal property. We had to fill out called an ARPA permit, Archaeological Resource Protection Act permit in order to be allowed to be there, because it's illegal to take things off of federal property otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Bill, what did you know going into this dig about what had been there, who had been there?
What we knew before were some historical records talking about Newport, and we also had a sketch map that was actually drawn in the 1940s, which is over a century after the actual Newport was there, showing us a basic layout of what we were hoping to find. Mm-hmm. And we also talked to some local people who had seen materials out there. And basically from there, we decided to go out and see what we could find.
What was the time frame for Newport and its existence?
It was founded 1878. or should let's say we step back. It started in 1787. Wow. Mm-hmm. and it lasted until about 1830. So it lasted about 40 years.
Why just so, that seems like such a short time for a location, for a settlement.
It came into existence as a transportation node. It was a river town servicing stuff coming out of Indiana County and along the Frankstown Road from the east and getting on the Kanama to come down towards Pittsburgh and eventually into the Ohio River system. But as the transportation shifted away from rivers to canals and then to trains, the need for the town faded away, and it was replaced by Blairsville as a main hub in the area.
So let's bring everybody into the conversation now. Jamie and Nadia, you had the background of where you were going for a 6-week venture, right?
Yes.
What were you expecting to find when you got there? Nadia, let's start with you.
Sure. Definitely not this. it's honestly been a great experience, though. I had no clue what to expect. We've always had the historical aspect of it, but we've never had the actual hands-on, so... As a student, it's been really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Jamie?
I agree with Nadia. A lot of times in your undergrad, you are taught theory, which is mm-hmm. great. You need mm-hmm. anthropological theory. But in going to field school, you receive the practice, and you can get a lot out of that. A lot of stuff that you aren't expecting when you go into it, because you think, okay, I know what this is going to be, and you don't. You really don't. But everything that you learn is beneficial.
Gentlemen, expectations going into this day.
I find that it's best not to have a whole lot of expectations with archaeology because it's sort of that idea that as soon as you go out into the field, things change, right? So we had some maps, we had some historical documents, but until you actually can find what's there, you never really know. So we had hoped to find evidence of Newport, and what we found was that, plus a lot of earlier stuff as well. So it's always a surprise.
Looking back, though, does it seem logical that you would find evidence of earlier civilizations, earlier inhabitants, because it was along the banks of a river? Rivers were so important, whether they were water sources or for fishing or for travel.
Right. Right. In Pennsylvania, there's a lot of we have a lot of trails that people in the prehistory would travel on, but we don't think about the rivers. Are trails also. So trails cross rivers, and then the rivers connect the trails. And again, we're at a confluence of two streams, and that's a perfect location for people to be inhabiting.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking with Professors Ben Ford and Bill Chadwick and IUP students Nadia Meister and Jamie Kuba, who during a dig this summer found artifacts that could date back 8,000 years. So, a little more about what you actually found.
It's been really, really cool. I expected only to find, you know, some small little pieces of ceramics and stuff like that, but we found everything all the way from a pig jawbone to some pretty, pretty big sizes of pottery that hopefully we'll be able to kind of put back together a little bit in the lab.
Jamie, what were you impressed by?
So on my first day of class, I had asked Dr. Ford if we expected to hit a prehistoric occupation level, because I have a little bit more experience, and so I was kind of expecting it.
Prehistoric or pre-European contact?
Both.
Okay.
I was actually expecting both, but mm-hmm. I didn't know how far down we were going. So I was pleasantly surprised in my first unit where we started hitting flakes from making of stone tools. And mm-hmm. then we ended up finding, it looks like, I guess you'd call it a hand scraper. It's a stone tool that would have been used to, like, scrape pelts and stuff. And so for me, that was pretty exciting because that's kind of my favorite part of archaeology is the pre-contact.
Okay, we've been using two different terms here a little bit, the pre-contact and prehistoric. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of there's a divide in North American archaeology where there's sort of a break point when the Europeans show up. And sort of the traditional nomenclature has been to call sort of before Europeans prehistoric. And we're sort of getting away from that more and more because it implies that Native peoples didn't have history. Yeah. And they obviously mm-hmm. had history both in some forms written and also oral history. And so, but pre-contact and prehistoric, as we're using it, are pretty much synonymous.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ben. So when you saw an artifact that obviously dated well back before the Newport Village establishment, what was your reaction?
It was happiness, I guess, is a good way. I mean, it's good news, and because I think it makes for a richer story that way.
Mm-hmm. Bill?
Yeah, the landscape at Newport is essentially on the side of a hill. So as we delved into it and looking at the landscape, there are small, somewhat level areas, but they have evidence of this occupation that's pre-European, mm-hmm. which wasn't expected on my part. I was mm-hmm. thinking we're on the side of a hill. It's unlikely we'd find any prehistory until we got up on top.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nadia and Jamie talked about what they were impressed by, but what was found. Was there a particular artifact that really excited you?
Jamie, being the graduate students, they were working on a road, looking for a road. And one of the interesting things is that when we went over to this sunken landscape that was linear, it was fairly flat. And when they started excavating, the fact that actually there were a lot of stone, large stones, mm-hmm. kind of like cobblestones. Mm-hmm. And so that was interesting for me in that sense, that they probably have found a road that was actually improved, not just a dirt road. And the number of prehistoric artifacts, Native American artifacts that were coming out of the site was impressive to me.
Ben?
Yeah, I think to sort of follow up on what Bill was saying, the road is really important, and Bill, nail that down, because we have documents that describe sort of the layout, but until we can tie those documents to the physical landscape with something like a road or a building, that's the documents don't have as much use to us. And so finding the road, we've also identified what's likely a structure. And so we can, with those things, we can start to repopulate and sort of rebuild the town.
Do the findings change ideas about who was settled there in the past?
I would say they confirm it, actually. I'd say that rumor becomes fact when you're able to find evidence of the past to show you who was there for sure.
Mm-hmm. And it's really important, too, to kind of be able to adjust our own knowledge of what we've already had based on these new ideas of, like you guys had said, where the roads were, where these buildings are, and we can build off of, you know, this history we've seen in the past and kind of create our own knowledge for future archaeologists and future people.
So several Native American tribes were known to have lived in southwestern Pennsylvania through the years. Any sense of which group might have been inhabiting this area?
At this point, we don't know. We don't have a lot of materials to actually be able to date when it may have been occupied. Mm-hmm. So we don't really know who the people were.
Is that a question you're still looking for answers, though?
Yes, yes, because we just came out of the field, and we still have a lot of artifacts
to examine and study further.
Yes.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking with IUP professors Ben Ford and Bill Chadwick and two of their students, Nadia Meister and Jamie Kuba, about their recent archaeological dig that unearthed artifacts from long before Europeans came to the Americas. So, gentlemen, how does the archaeology field school project work? Give us a sense of what goes into the process. Ben?
So it's basically an internship or almost a training experience for the students. And so we get the permits and we set up the field school, but we work closely with the students to determine kind of how we're going to do the process. And then they go through all of the steps of the archaeological process. And we mirror, when we do our field school, we base it on what happens in the archaeological industry and cultural resource management, which is a large industry in the United States. And so they go through various steps of, you know, trying to find the sites as well as then testing the sites to understand them better. And so that's sort of the approach we take.
Was this the first year at the Newport site?
Yes.
Where have you been before?
We do a field school every year, and we usually alternate between an historic period, sort of European field site, and usually a pre-contact Native American site. And so most recently, we've been working at Hannistown, which is in Westmoreland County, and also at the Squirrel Hill site, which is a late prehistoric Native American site.
Yes, it's just outside of New Florence, mm-hmm. so it's not the Squirrel Hill.
Not the Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh.
Yes, and that one is identified as a Monongahela site, again on the Conemaugh, a few miles away, about 10 miles away from where we are in Newport.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So Jamie and Nadia,
how's
the program, both in the class and seemingly more excited you are about the field work, but how's that prepared you for life after IUP?
I mean, the goal of college is to get a job. And that's what's so nice about this department is it's very hands-on. And especially, you know, I'm only going to be a sophomore. I've only done like 2 semesters. And to get this chance to be out there in the field, be out there getting dirty is really amazing because it helps you determine, okay, this is what I want to do. This is an important aspect of how life is going
to
be.
All right. Jamie, you're closer to being out there in the real world.
I am. God help me. So one of the great things about the field school is that you get required field time. Because when you go to apply for a job, if you don't have any field experience, they don't want you. I mean, that's really what it is. They want you to have this hands-on practical experience. So it's really important. But one of the other things that I think is incredibly important that IUP does that some other places may not, is that there's a real sense of, I guess, hands-on experience where you, the student, are doing it. You're not learning it from somebody. You're not hearing about it. You're not reading about it. You're actually doing it. And I think that that takes theory to a whole other level when you can apply it like that.
Okay. You've just really recently come in from the field. How long do you think you'll be studying the artifacts that you did discover? And what is it you really want to learn?
Okay. So it'll the kind of the old adage about anthropology or archaeology is that for every month in the field, you've got 2 months in the lab or in the archives, and so we'll be working with these materials through the fall and winter and probably into the spring to prepare a report for the Army Corps of Engineers and some research product as well. And I'm hoping that when we come out of this, we'll have a better idea of the dates for the site in terms of how long people live there, as well as ability to link the historic documents about Newport Village to the physical landscape. Those are the two outcomes I would like to have.
So the 8,000 years, that's an estimate. Do you think that's a conservative estimate? Where do you think that lies?
It's not a bad estimate at this point.
Right.
Again, we have to go through all the artifacts. Again, some things catch your eye. Other things you may not have caught your eye while you're in the field. And through the analysis, you find new information. So that may change moving forward. We just don't know yet because, again, we just came out of the field. Everything's in a archival bag right now. And so we'll be processing them and, again, getting some conclusions. Hopefully we will be using some of the students this to work with the artifacts.
Do you plan on going back to Newport Village?
Yes, we'd like to go back in about 2 years. It's been a really great place to train students.
Okay. Jamie, yes. And Nadia, although the field school is over for you, what do you want to learn from the artifacts that you helped gather?
So as a grad student, Dr. Chadwick said that we had our own project that we had to execute. And one of the things that we were looking for were the convergence of two roads that ran through and next to Newport. And I would like to continue working with the artifacts and the collection and see if we can find a more narrow date for those. There was one that we definitely found, the stone-covered road, and then there's another one that we may have found. So I would really like to go back and see if we can tell with the artifacts and stuff exactly if we nailed it.
Nadia.
Definitely. I'd be really interested in a lot of the historic artifacts we found, actually, because as interesting as the prehistorics are, we've got a lot of really interesting pieces like printware with cool designs on it. And it'd be really cool to see, how did this get here? How did such a wide range of things end up in the same spot?
Ben Ford is the chair of the Department of Anthropology at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Bill Chadwick is director of archaeological services. Nadia Meister and Jamie Kuba are students at IUP. Their team found artifacts that date back maybe as far as 8,000 years ago. Congratulations and thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been pretty cool to be here.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Robert Morris University, private university, has taken another step in trying to show it can be a better cost options for students who are facing tens of thousands of dollars in future debt. Wendy Beckemeyer is Robert Morris's Vice President of Enrollment Management. She joins us on the line. Welcome. Good to talk to you, Wendy.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Wendy, a year ago, you began the Public Price Match Scholarship Program. Briefly, would you explain how that works? Briefly.
Sure. So students who are admitted to Robert Morris University and also admitted to either Pitt or Penn State and now also WVU or Kent can receive an equitable cost of tuition plus a $3,000 scholarship. So we average the cost of attendance for both Pitt and Penn State for in-state students, and this scholarship is eligible to Pennsylvania residents who will be living on the Robert Morris campus. We average the cost of attendance, which includes tuition, books, personal expenses, travel, room and board, the whole cost of attendance, and then subtract that cost of attendance from Robert Morris's cost of attendance, and then provide, in addition to that, a $3,000 scholarship on top. The same is true for WVU and Kent. They're out-of-state tuition and all of those costs, so the scholarship is slightly different in amount for the WVU and Kent program.
All right. So they've already been accepted to these other schools. So is this a sort of last chance recruiting by you, maybe even a little poaching?
I would say no. One of the things that we hear a lot about on a national level is that needy, high-achieving students don't always get to attend their institution of choice. And so we're really, you know, going up front, which is, you know, one of the challenges for families is what will college cost up front. That's why the government put together the net price calculator for institutions. So this is our take on college affordability, and we do many other initiatives related to college affordability as well, at being transparent and letting families know up front what it's going to cost to come to Robert Morris.
And knowing that the public schools, including Pitt and Penn State, are regularly up there at the top of the list in cost across the nation. But I was curious, in our last couple of minutes, do you still have to deal with a smaller pool of potential high school graduates because the demographics of those that age group has gone down, so there are fewer students to recruit from within Pennsylvania?
That is absolutely true. Their demographics are challenging. We're all facing that. The average student that has participated in this program this year is a 3.91 GPA and over an SAT average of 1250. So these are really strong students, but the demographics are going down, and we're all competing very aggressively for the students who are located here in this state.
Are you looking, so Pitt, Penn State last year, now the University of West Virginia and Kent State University, are you looking at matching other schools in the future? Are you going to wait to see how this plays out?
Absolutely. So we you know, the idea behind this is for the benefit of the student. And if we see that students are benefiting from this program and that we could potentially find other matches between RMU and the students, we will expand the program.
And how will you assess in a sentence or two the success of this program? Strictly a number of students? What?
We look at the number of students. We look, for instance, are we helping students of high need? We have a number of students in this first cohort that are Pell eligible, and so the idea of providing access to needy students is important to RMU, and we've done that successfully. So we're looking at the quality of the pool that's coming in, the need that they have, and were we able to be transparent, which is our goal.
Wendy Beckemeyer is the Vice President of Enrollment Management at Robert Morris University. Thanks so much for taking some time today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the invitation.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Pittsburgh Health Data Alliance is partnering with the Familiar Face for Retail to improve health research using machine learning and AI. Plus, Lancaster County is home to 10% of the nation's Amish population, and they're still growing. Tomorrow, look at what rapid development means for a modern Amish way of life. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Maruka and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.